Hello, 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 geeks, freaks, and tomb dwellers, and welcome back to the Tombs of Horror for the Season 3 finale. As always, I'm your host, Dustin. Before we get into everything, let me just announce that after this episode, I will be taking a two-week break from releasing episodes, but I will be returning just about in time for Valentine's Day on February 12th. I mean, of course, Valentine's Day isn't on the 12th, but I will be returning the 12th with the special Valentine's Day episode for all you horror lovers. So, like I said, I'll be taking a two-week break, but will be returning on February 12th. And so, for this Season 3 finale, I decided that I would talk about some psychological horror movies. Psychological horror isn't my most favorite subgenre of horror. They're all pretty predictable when it gets down to it, but there are a few that I have actually liked that I will also get into in this episode. So without further ado, let's get into the first one, a personal favorite, and that is 1996's Pinocchio's Revenge.
A bizarre piece of evidence in the trial of an accused child killer.
How could the man who made this have murdered his only child?
Evil comes in all shapes and sizes.
His lawyer believed he was innocent, but she couldn't stop his execution. Now, her daughter has been given something she was never meant to have.
Sorry, she spotted it before I could get a rat.
And the soul of a murderer may have found a new home.
I've always been having these horrible, violent nightmares lately. Zoe, what are you doing up? Her therapist thinks she has a lot of repressed hostility.
Pinocchio, can't become a real boy if you keep doing bad things.
Very disturbed little girl.
He's protecting me from Pinocchio.
I know what evil looks like. I see it in the eyes of my clients. And I'm telling you, I don't see it in my daughter.
You have the powers.
Pinocchio can't hurt me.
Give me life.
What do I have to do?
Cut my strings.
Jennifer Garrick is a lawyer who is defending a convicted child murderer, Vincent Gatto, who is accused of murdering his own child, or his own young child. But despite all the overwhelming evidence that proves that he did it, Jennifer still believes that he is not the real killer. A fellow attorney in Jennifer's office explains the presence of a large Pinocchio-type puppet sitting in her chair, previously buried by Gatto in his son's grave, as belatedly delivered evidence which she had earlier questioned. Intending to examine the puppet in the hope of finding a clue which might prevent Gatto's execution, Jennifer brings it home and her emotionally fragile daughter, Zoe, mistakes it for a birthday present. Zoe soon develops a relationship with the Pinocchio puppet and becomes unbalanced to an even greater degree. The real trouble begins when Zoe's bully at school is pushed in front of a bus, which Zoe blames on Pinocchio trying to protect her. Soon after this, Jennifer's boyfriend, David Kaminsky, is knocked down the basement stairs while babysitting Zoe, but is saved when she calls 911. Later, Zoe is at one of her therapy sessions when her psychiatrist, Dr. Edwards, has to leave the room. Zoe then begins talking with Pinocchio about who is to blame for David's accident, with each placing blame on the other. Jennifer and Dr. Edwards watch the argument through a video feed and see that Zoe is talking to herself. That night, Pinocchio convinces Zoe to set him free on the pretense that he will confess to David about causing his accident. Zoe makes him promise he will not do anything bad and cuts his strings, at which point Pinocchio takes off for the hospital with Zoe in hot pursuit. Then, through a first-person perspective, we see an unknown person walk into David's room and unplug his life support machine, killing him. When Zoe denies to Jennifer that she visited the hospital and blames David's death on Pinocchio, an angry and confused Jennifer locks the puppet in the trunk of her car. That night, Zoe is left in the care of her babysitter, Sophia, who reminds Zoe that she gave Pinocchio a conscience in the form of a cricket she caught earlier. Zoe runs to her room to check on the cricket, only to find that it has been killed. Sophia then runs to the sound of Zoe's screams, only to be attacked and killed by someone wielding a fireplace poker. Jennifer then arrives home to find the babysitter dead, and Zoe standing in a dark hallway. When she tries to confront Zoe, the girl runs away in a panic, and as Jennifer explores the house, she is struck by the poker and sees her daughter standing above her with it in her hand. Zoe then explains that she just managed to get the poker away from Pinocchio, but before Jennifer can inquire further, she vanishes. Jennifer then stands up to see Pinocchio standing in the room, at which point he suddenly turns towards her and attacks her with a knife. Following a pursuit through the house, Jennifer finally throws Pinocchio through a glass coffee table, only to see that her daughter is suddenly lying in the puppet's place. And then the movie ends with the catatonic Zoe being committed. Jennifer vows not to give up until Zoe recovers and comes home, to which Dr. Edwards states, "I hope not, for your sake, I hope not." Even though I said at the beginning of this segment that this is a personal favorite of mine, it is really predictable, and it's fairly derivative of Child's Play. It actually dangerously really closely walks the line of plagiarism at times when it comes to copying Child's Play. But for as low budget of a movie that this is, it's actually really good. The acting is better than it should be, and the effects are actually pretty neat, especially when it comes to Pinocchio. And the Pinocchio doll itself is actually pretty fucking creepy. It's not something that I would want sitting in my room at night. I can be damn sure of that. But like I said, even though it is very derivative of Child's Play, it's still a decent enough little killer toy movie. And like I said, the ending is pretty predictable, but that's probably the biggest downfall of the movie. IMDb gave it a 4.1 out of 10. Rotten Tomatoes a 20%. Letterboxd a 2.5 out of 5. And I give it a 3.8 out of 5. Next up, we have 2003's Identity.
There was a storm.
We had an accident.
And we got stuck, and we couldn't get out. We couldn't get out because of the storm.
It's flooded. It's dead end.
You're the manager? Officer Rose. Transporting a prisoner here. But the roads are all flooded. I could use a room.
Get out tonight.
I'm not staying here. Are you out of your mind?
There is no place else to go.
What happened to the motel? People started dying.
What's going on?
Go in your room and lock your door.
They disappeared.
Nobody in there.
That's not possible. I saw what happened. We all saw what happened.
This doesn't make any sense.
Maybe there's some connection between all of us.
Like what?
My birthday next week.
Me too.
Me too.
The movie opens with a death row convict named Malcolm Rivers awaiting execution for several vicious murders that took place at an apartment building. Journals belonging to Malcolm are discovered misfiled in the case evidence not introduced during the trial. Malcolm's psychiatrist, Dr. Malik, and his defense attorney argue to use the evidence at a midnight hearing to prove Malcolm's insanity. Meanwhile, 10 strangers find themselves stranded in the middle of a torrential rainstorm at a remote Nevada motel run by Larry Washington. The group consists of an ex-cop, now limousine driver, Ed Dakota, Caroline Suzanne, a washed-up, irritable actress, Officer Rohde, who is transporting convicted murderer Robert Main, Paris Nevada, a prostitute, newlyweds Lou and Jenny Isiana, and the New York family, George Alice, and their 9-year-old son, Timmy. With both ends of the road completely flooded, the group is forced to spend the night at the motel. As everyone is settling down for the night, Suzanne is killed by an unknown assailant. Ed then soon discovers Suzanne's head in a dryer, along with the number 10 motel key. Main is suspected to be the killer, and he is found to have escaped. And he has been found to have escaped. Ed alerts the others about Suzanne's death and Main's escape. Lou and Jenny get into a fight, leading them back to their motel room. Jenny then locks herself in the bathroom as they argue through the door, only for Lou to be murdered, with his body found by the other guests in their room. Meanwhile, at the hearing, the contents of Malcolm's diaries are revealed, indicating Malcolm suffers from an extreme case of dissociative identity disorder, harboring 11 distinct personalities. His defense attorney argues that Malcolm is completely unaware of the crimes for which he is being executed, which is in violation of existing Supreme Court rulings on capital punishment. Dr. Malik is introducing the concept of integrating the personalities of someone with dissociative identity disorder as Malcolm is brought into the hearing. Meanwhile, back at the motel, while taking photos of Lou's crime scene and talking with Paris, Ed finds the number 9 key in Lou's bloody hands. He begins to suspect that the killer is counting down and targeting them in order. Meanwhile, Main fails to escape the motel area and is subdued by Rohde and Ed. They tie Main to a pole and Larry is appointed to guard him, but Main is killed after Larry leaves his post. Rohde and Ed find the number 8 key next to Main's body and harass Larry, who takes Paris hostage. However, Paris wrestles him off, causing Larry to run away and attempt to escape in his truck, but he accidentally crushes George against a dumpster as he tries to save Timmy from being run over. Rohde then ties Larry to a chair and orders the other guests to stay until dawn. Larry convinces Paris and Ed that he's not the perpetrator by telling them how he ended up at the motel. Alice, still in bed, is checked on and presumably has died from her injuries. But Rohde finds the number 6 key next to her. George's body is recovered from the front of Larry's truck, and the number 7 key is found in his pocket, which confuses the others. Ed then tells Jenny and Timmy to flee in a car near the edge of the motel, but it explodes. The last 4 survivors discover that the bodies of all the previous victims have disappeared. Paris then has a mental breakdown, revealing her birthday is to be May 10th. And it turns out that all 11 people were born on May 10th, which is also Malcolm's birthday and the day he committed the murders. Ed then leaves the other 3 and checks their ID cards in the office, discovering that each one of them is named after a state and that their birthdays all match. With Dr. Malik calling out to him, Ed finds that he's at the hearing, but is confused as to why he is there. Dr. Malik explains that he is one of the personalities that Malcolm Rivers created as a child, and learning one of the personalities committed the murders, Ed is instructed to go back to the motel to try to eliminate them. As Ed returns to the motel, Paris finds convict transportation files for both Main and Rohde in the police car, revealing that Rohde is a criminal acting as an officer. Rohde attacks Paris, but she is saved by Larry, who is then shot to death by Rohde. Finally, believing Rohde is to be the murderous personality, Ed goes after him, and the 2 men end up shooting each other fatally, leaving only Paris still alive. With the homicidal personality removed, Malcolm's execution is stayed, and he is ordered to be placed in a mental institution under Dr. Malik's care. In Malcolm's mind, Paris settles down in her hometown of Frostproof, Florida.
As she tends to her orange grove, she discovers the number one key buried in dirt and finds Timmy behind her. It is revealed Timmy orchestrated all the deaths at the motel, including faking his own death. Timmy then kills Paris, while Malcolm strangles Malik, causing the van that is en route to the mental institution to swerve off the road and stop before Timmy's voice repeats the poem Antigonish by William Hughes Mearns one more time, and the movie ends. Identity is one of the main reasons why I don't like psychological horror movies. I mean, it's really not a bad movie. I mean, it starts out good, but then as the movie goes on, it starts to get confusing, and it starts jumping all over the fucking place to where you kind of forget what the hell is going on, and then things start to not make all that much sense. The ending is decent enough, but it's just something is missing from it. But it does have a good cast. It has such familiar faces as John Cusack, Ray Liotta, Amanda Peet, Clea DuVall, Rebecca De Mornay, and Jake Busey. And they all do a decent enough job in this movie, but it just isn't enough to save it from just being so-so. This had a budget of $28 million, but ended up bringing in $90.3 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 7.3 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 62%, Letterboxd a 3.5 out of 5, and I give it a 3 out of 5. And that brings us to the next movie, 2005's Hide and Seek.
I'm gonna move. Upstate. The country.
What about Emily? This is a traumatic time for her. I think it's important she stays here and works through this.
Oh, here she's flooded with memories. But right now, I need to be a full-time dad.
It's gonna be a real treat having both of you here.
I didn't even realize anyone else lived up there.
Well, it does get pretty quiet in the off-season.
I have a new friend.
A new friend?
He told me to call him Charlie.
When did you meet Charlie?
Today.
When we went to town?
It was before that.
Is he here right now?
It was Charlie.
It's not unusual for a child to create imaginary friends.
I don't want to be too forward, but I don't notice a lot of kids around, and I'm trying to find other kids to have play dates with Emily.
Do you like her, Daddy?
Emily.
Charlie says you do.
Stop this.
Did Daddy tell you about my mommy? Let's hope you don't wind up like her.
You know, Charlie doesn't exist.
You shouldn't say that.
Why not?
Gonna make him mad. Do you like games?
I love games. Would you like to play one?
I'm already playing. Charlie did it. You do believe me, don't you, Daddy?
Neighbor called, said there was a problem. What you drawing there?
You. Die. 3-1000. 4-1000.
'The suicide and discovery of his wife's body in the bathtub after her long bout of depression, Dr. David Calloway, a psychologist, decides to move with his 9-year-old daughter, Emily, to upstate New York. There, Emily makes an imaginary friend she calls Charlie, and her friendship with Charlie begins to disturb David when he discovers their cat dead in the bathtub, who Emily claims was a victim of Charlie. David then has nightmares of the New Year's Eve party that occurred the night before Allison's death. When a family friend, Dr. Catherine Carson, comes to visit David, Emily reveals that she and Charlie have a mutual desire to upset her father. David then meets Elizabeth Young, a local woman, and her niece Amy, who is the same age as Emily. Hoping to cultivate a healthy friendship for Emily, David sets up a playdate and Amy is eager to become friends and gives one of her dolls to Emily, but the playdate is spoiled when Emily cuts up Amy's doll's face. Emily then tells David she doesn't need any friends. David then invites Elizabeth over to dinner one night, where Emily acts very hostile towards her. Elizabeth later tries to make peace with Emily, and when Emily tells her that she is playing hide-and-seek with Charlie, Elizabeth indulges her by pretending to look for Charlie. When she opens a closet, someone bursts out and pushes Elizabeth to her death. David then asks Emily what happened. Emily claims Charlie killed Elizabeth and forced Emily to help him move the body. She tells David the location of the body, and David discovers Elizabeth in a bathtub full of blood, similar to how Allison, his wife, died. And armed with a knife, he goes outside where he meets their neighbor and assumes that his neighbor is Charlie. He cuts the neighbor, and the neighbor calls the police. Back at the house, David finds that although he has been in his study many times, the boxes were actually never unpacked after the move. He realizes that he has dissociative identity disorder, and Charlie is not imaginary at all. Charlie is, in fact, David himself. Whenever Charlie would emerge, David would be in his study. He also finally recalls the New Year's Eve party the night before his wife's death, where he had caught Allison making out with another guest, and Charlie was then created as a way to express David's rage so that he could murder his wife, something the docile David was too decent to do. Emily knew the entire time about her father's split personality, but did not tell him because she was unsure which personality murdered her mother until Charlie killed Elizabeth. Once David realizes the truth, he becomes completely consumed by Charlie, leading him to murder the local sheriff, who arrives to investigate the neighbor. Emily then calls Catherine for help, tricks Charlie, and escapes into the cave where she originally met Charlie. Catherine takes a gun from the dead sheriff and finds Charlie in the cave, where he pretends to be David, but then attacks Catherine. Catherine begs for David to fight his murderous other personality, and Charlie says that David no longer exists. Emily emerges, begging Charlie to let Catherine go, and her distraction allows Catherine to shoot Charlie, finally killing him. Later, Emily is preparing for school in her new life with Catherine, but Emily's drawings of herself with two heads suggest that she might also have dissociative identity disorder. This movie actually has 5 different endings. I'm not going to get into them all. If you want to see them, watch the DVD. They're all included on it. This is one of those movies that really didn't get a lot of good press when it first came out, despite the fact that it stars Robert De Niro and a very young Dakota Fanning. And I think this is the only horror movie De Niro has ever actually done, I believe. Don't quote me on that. But it's a lot better than the critics made it out to be, even though if you do pay attention, the twist ending with Charlie being David the entire time, if you pay attention, it doesn't come as a surprise at all. Just like in The Sixth Sense, if you pay attention, you know that Bruce Willis's character has been dead the entire fucking time. Spoiler alert, if you've never actually seen that fucking movie for some reason. But again, it's a decent enough movie, and it deserves a lot more attention than it ever got. This had a budget of $25 million and brought in $127.4 million at the box office, despite all the bad reviews. IMDb gave it a 6 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 13%, Letterboxd a 2.5 out of 5, and I give it a 3.5 out of 5. Next up, we have 1978's Magic.
When your heart begins to pound, when your mind begins to go, keep telling yourself, it's only a movie.
You do magic too?
Corky does magic. I only do tricks.
There's never been a magician like him.
How long you been like this, kid?
You never really told why you were here.
Hiding. Wasn't that cheap in New York?
You won success, but you're afraid of it.
I figured I'd stop by here and ask you folks about you. Not afraid. Where were you living? What city? How many kids?
I'm not afraid.
Never expected to find you. I've loved you all my damn life.
I won't be here.
I was afraid of success. Like you said, I needed to get my head on straight.
And now you're fine?
Sure, on account of Peg. I've known her ever since high school. I never figured I'd have a chance, but...
Peg Yams, no, please, let me follow. Wherever you go.
That you'll need to take up.
I love Peg.
Just the two of us. Now everything's changed. She believes me.
A man appears after 15 years. Says run away with me.
Don't do it. Oh, please, don't kill her.
After Charles Corky Withers fails in his first attempt at professional magic, his mentor, Merlin, says that he needs to have a better gimmick. A year later, Corky comes back as a combination magician and ventriloquist with a foul-mouthed dummy named Fats, becoming a huge success. Corky's powerful agent, Ben Green, is on the verge of signing him for his own television show, but Corky bails out for the Catskills, where he grew up. His silent agent thinks that Corky is afraid of success, but in truth, Corky does not want to take the TV network's required medical examination because the doctors might find out that he suffers from severe mental issues and that even offstage, he cannot control Fats, who is a manifestation of Corky's id. In the Catskills, Corky reunites with his high school crush, Peggy Ann Snow, who is stuck in a passionless marriage with Duke, Corky's friend from high school. A magic trick with a deck of cards charms Peggy into thinking they are soulmates, leading them to have sex. This sparks a jealousy not only of Duke, but also the dummy Fats. In the midst of an argument between Corky and Fats, Green arrives unexpectedly and confronts Corky, discovering the truth about Corky's state of mind. Corky pleads that nothing is wrong with him and that he's just rehearsing, so Green puts him to the test, saying make Fats shut up for 5 minutes. Corky puts aside Fats, but is unable to last 5 minutes without delivering a rapid stream of speech through Fats. Green then demands that Corky get help and leaves to make some calls to the doctors, but Fats convinces Corky to kill his agent. Corky then chases after Green in the woods and bludgeons him with Fats' hard wooden head, and then attempts to drag the body into a lake. However, a still-living Green suddenly lunges at him, causing Corky to drown. Next morning, Fats becomes even more possessive and jealous when Corky says that he plans to elope with Peggy and leave the dummy behind. Duke returns from his trip earlier than expected, and suspecting his wife has cheated on him, he wants to have a talk with Corky by the lake. Rather than confront him, Duke awkwardly confides to Corky that he loves Peggy and is worried about losing her. Duke then suddenly spots Green's body on the edge of the lake, and Duke, believing Green could still be alive, sends Corky to get help. Curious, he decides to search Corky's cabin, where Fats stabs him with a knife with help from Corky. An increasingly deranged Corky then manages to pull himself together and persuade Peggy to run away with him, but she insists on waiting to tell Duke to his face. She thinks everything is fine until Fats comes alive and reveals that Corky's card trick is only a ruse he uses to seduce women and that Peggy is only the latest of his conquests. Repulsed, she rejects Corky and locks herself in her bedroom. Fats then says that from this point on, he will be making the decisions in Corky's life, immediately asserting that this new authority by ordering Corky to kill Peggy. Corky, turning on a charm and using Fats' voice, apologizes to Peggy through her locked door and leaves her a wooden heart that he carved. A short while later, Corky returns with the bloodstained knife, and Fats seems pleased, until it is revealed that the blood on the knife is Corky's, who has fatally stabbed himself so that he will not kill anyone. As a result, Fats also feels faint, and they wonder which one of them will die first. Moments later, Peggy returns to the cabin, happily calling out that she has changed her mind and has decided to run away with Corky after all. As she speaks, she playfully changes her voice to impersonate Fats, and the movie ends. Although this movie hasn't aged particularly well, it's very good. The ending leaves much to be desired. It really doesn't offer much closure. Even though we are left to assume that Corky really was the puppet master, if you will, there's still a little doubt left that Fats may have actually been alive. But it's never really brought to a conclusion that way, and it just kind of ends abruptly. But still, it's a very good movie. If you've seen the trailer for it, the trailer is creepy as fuck. You just have to look it up on YouTube. The short 23-second version of the trailer that features just Fats. It's a really fucking creepy trailer. So you should definitely check that out as well. This had a budget of $7 million and brought in $23.8 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 6.8 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes an 85%, Letterboxd a 3.4 out of 5, and I give it a 4 out of 5. Next up, we have 2002's Frailty.
Agent in charge of the case?
That's right. What can I do for you?
I'm here because I can't live with what I know anymore. Listen, this may sound a little bit crazy, but I know who the goddamn killer is.
What makes you think that?
You hadn't even heard me out yet, and already you doubt me.
They were raised to obey their father.
Go to see Omar.
To love him. To trust him.
Night, boys. Sleep tight.
Don't let those bed bugs bite.
Until...
Wake up. I've got something to tell you.
Hey, what's wrong?
There are demons among us. I can see the demons while other people can.
I'm scared, Dad.
Nothing that crazy could be real.
The angel told me that God would be sending weapons.
Maybe you just dreamed it. Maybe you're not right in the head.
God will be sending a list of the first 7 demons.
These are people's names.
And they'll look like people. They're not.
Dad made up this whole thing. Do you understand?
Well, if it has to be done, it has to be done.
Is that true?
Why would I make it up?
It's all a big lie. I don't want to run away.
You are hiding something from me.
What is it you think I'm hiding?
I'll lay my hands on them. I'll reveal them for what they truly are.
I got a pretty good idea of them bodies are.
I'll tell.
Craziest thing I've heard in a long time.
Check the rose garden.
I don't believe a word of it.
But it's true.
Bill Paxton.
Those were demons, so why can't you see that?
Matthew McConaughey.
Tell me the truth.
Sometimes truth defies reason.
You're crazy!
Only demons should fear me. You're not a demon, are you?
My bad, this was released in 2001, not 2003, like I said. But anyway, the movie opens with Fenton Meeks visiting FBI agent Wesley Doyle, claiming that his brother Adam is a culprit in the God's Hand serial killings. Fenton says Adam has committed suicide, prompting Fenton to fulfill a promise to bury his brother in a public rose garden in their hometown of Thurman. He begins to tell Doyle about the boy's childhood and suggests that the bodies of the God's Hand's victims are buried in the rose garden. In the summer of 1979, when the brothers were children, their father told them that he had been visited by an angel and tasked by God with destroying demons disguised as human beings, a mission which must be kept secret. Their father is led to 3 tools, an axe, gloves, and a pipe. He receives a list of names from the angels as well. He incapacitates a woman with the pipe and brings her home to kill with the axe. When he lays his hand on her, he claims to see a vision of her evil, then kills her and makes the boys help him bury in the rose garden. Fenton is horrified and believes his father insane, while Adam claims he sees the visions and supports their father. After telling Doyle about the first killings, Doyle drives them to Thurman. On the way, Doyle tells Fenton that his mother had been murdered by someone that was never caught. Fenton then tells Doyle how they took the second victim in broad daylight, with his father insisting God would blind any witnesses. One night, Fenton's father tells him that after praying for the angel to visit Fenton, for his lack of faith, the angel instead visited him, and told him something bad about Fenton. He makes Fenton dig a hole, and Fenton abandons all faith in God. Their father then makes the hole into a cellar and moves the shed on top of it. During the third episode, Fenton escapes from the cellar and runs to the sheriff, who takes him back home. To quiet Fenton's apparent ramblings, the sheriff looks in the cellar but finds it empty. As he leaves, however, their father kills him and is angry with Fenton for making him murder an innocent man. After burying the body, Fenton's father tells him the angel told him Fenton was a demon, and to save him and encourage him to have faith, he locks Fenton in the cellar for over a week. Fenton then claims to have been enlightened, and his father releases him to carry out the next killing. Fenton cooperates with his father to take the next victim, but alerts him just before his father hits him in the head with the pipe, nearly blowing the scheme. In the cellar, Fenton readies to kill the man with the axe, but kills his father instead. And then as he tries to release the man, Adam takes up the axe and kills him anyway. While burying the two men, Fenton makes Adam promise to bury him in the garden if he ever destroys him. We then cut back to present day, where Doyle is puzzled by his phrasing, since he said Adam killed himself. Fenton then reveals to Doyle that he is in fact Adam, and it is also revealed that Adam killed Fenton, who had grown up to become the actual God's Hand killer, in a series of unrelated murders not committed by Adam destroying demons. And Doyle is horrified to see the number of graves in the Rose Garden. Flashbacks reveal that Adam did in fact share his father's visions of the crimes of those they abducted, who were indeed demons. When Adam touches Doyle, a vision really reveals that Doyle murdered his mother, and that he was on Adam's list. Adam then kills him in a prepared grave as part of a long scheme to get him there. After Doyle disappears, Agent Griffin Hull, who saw Adam, can't remember his face. The security tapes are also inexplicably obscured by static whenever Adam is in view. The FBI then raids Fenton's house, finding the God's Hands list and Doyle's badge, which corroborates his being the killer. Agent Hull then visits Adam Meeks, a nearby county sheriff, to tell him Fenton was a killer. Upon shaking his hand, Adam declares the agent a good man, and it is, of course, the God Hands killer. This is probably the best psychological horror movie you've never seen. It did well at the box office, but it kind of faded into obscurity after it was released. And it slowly gained a cult following, but it is very good. The cast, which includes Matthew McConaughey, the late Bill Paxton, and Powers Booth, I'll do an excellent job. Bill Paxton is really creepy as Dad Meeks. And it's just a really good movie. It's more of a psychological slasher film than a psychological horror film, which I think makes it better than the average psychological horror film, which can all tend to be predictable. Not to say that the ending of this isn't predictable, but it's all done very well. This had a budget of $11 million and brought in $17.4 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 7.2 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 75%, Letterboxd a 4 out of 5, and I give it a 4.5 out of 5. Next up, we have 1988's Pin.
Pin is the one and only friend Leon's ever had. The only one who doesn't care that Leon's different.
God, it must be crazy to be here tonight. I defended you. Boy, was I dumb.
You never had secrets from each other.
Only Pin knows Leon's darkest secret.
Leon?
Hello, Marsha. Someone hurts Leon. Pin hurts them. When someone tries to come between them, Pin won't let them.
I don't think Aunt Dorothy will be staying with us for very long.
What do you mean?
Might take her a little while to feel the vibrations, but I think she will.
If you want to get closer to Leon, you'll have to take care of Pin before Pin takes care of you. Is Pin a friend?
Oh, please.
Or an enemy? Only Leon knows.
What have you done? What have you done?
What am I gonna do?
Pin, some friendships die hard.
Dr. Frank Linden is a doctor who has a life-size, anatomically correct medical dummy in his office, which he calls Pin. Using ventriloquism, Dr. Linden uses Pin to teach his children, Leon and Ursula, about bodily functions and how the body works in a way that children can relate to without it being awkward. Dr. Linden's interactions with the children are otherwise cold and emotionally distant, and his ventriloquism act is the only sign of a more warm and playful side to his nature. Unknown to Dr. Linden, Leon is mentally ill and has come to believe that Pin is alive, due in part to his mother, who discourages Leon from playing outdoors or bringing anyone home. Leon has no real friends and sees Pin as the closest analog. Leon is further traumatized when he secretly witnesses his father's nurse use Pin as a masturbatory sex doll. From that day on, he hates women with large breasts or promiscuity. When Leon turns 18, Dr. Linden, having come back to retrieve case studies for a speech, catches him having a conversation with Pin via ventriloquism, which Leon had learned. Realizing the extent of Leon's psychosis and that his son is mentally ill, Dr. Linden takes Pin away to use as a visual aid for a speech with the intention of leaving Pin at the medical school. As Dr. and Mrs. Linden speed towards the hall, they get into a car crash caused by either Dr. Linden's recklessness or Pin. The Lindens are both killed instantly. Later, as Ursula sits in the back of a police car crying, Leon secretly retrieves Pin from the scene. Leon and Ursula, though grieving and orphaned, enjoy their newfound freedom until Mrs. Linden's sister, Aunt Dorothy, moves in. She encourages Ursula to take a job at the library, which Leon is against. Believing that she is influencing Ursula, and after talking it over with Pin, Leon causes Aunt Dorothy to die from a heart attack by using Pin to frighten her. However, Ursula continues to work at the library, where she meets handsome athlete Stan Fraker and falls in love. Meanwhile, Leon takes his fixation with Pin to pathological extremes, first by dressing him in Dr. Linden's clothes and finally fitting him with latex skin and a wig. Believing that Stan is only interested in Ursula's inheritance and that he wants to put Leon in the sanitarium, Leon invites Stan over under the guise of discussing a surprise party for Ursula. Leon then drugs Stan's drink, and when Stan fights back, Leon bludgeons Stan with the wooden sculpture. Following Pin's instructions, he puts Stan in a bag and plans to dump him in the river. Leon, however, is interrupted by a call from Ursula, who says she intends to come home early. Leon then quickly hides Stan's body in a woodpile outside the house and cleans up the blood. To calm her, Leon tells Ursula that Stan is visiting a sick friend out of town, and she believes him until she discovers a gift she gave Stan and a wet spot on the carpet. When she confronts Leon, he blames it on Pin, which causes her to run out of the house in hysterics. Leon then asks Pin why he would not help him, and Pin states that he has never lied to or for him, and that it'll be useless for the need to lie anyway because they both have no idea how to. Leon, desperate and out of schemes, blamed his motives on Ursula, and Pin also pointed out that he was lying again, and that everything was by his own selfish motives. Ursula then returns with a double-bit axe, which she raises ready to strike, and the screen goes white as Leon screams and cowers. The police then find Stan's body, and to their amazement, he is still alive. Sometime later, Ursula and Stan return to the house to visit Pin, and Ursula tells him that she's going on a trip with Stan. Pin then inquires as to whether she's heard from Leon, and Ursula replies no. Pin says that he misses him a great deal, and Ursula agrees. As the story ends, it is revealed that Ursula is talking to Leon, who has taken Pin's persona. After Ursula destroyed her brother's only companion with an axe, Leon had a psychotic break, which left only the dummy's side of his personality to completely take over, with Leon essentially becoming Pin in the flesh. Based on the best-selling novel of the same name by Andrew Niederman, this movie is very reminiscent of Psycho, but it's not bad at all. It's not derivative. It doesn't copy it. It's just very reminiscent of it. And it's a Canadian film, and it never really got much attention when it was released, which is a shame, because this is actually a really good movie. It's pretty fucking creepy, and it's pretty much everything a good horror movie should be. And it doesn't give away too much too early, like a lot of psychological horror films do, and it kind of, which makes it hard to predict how it's going to end, which is always a good thing. IMDb gave it a 6.6 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 40%, Letterboxd a 3.4 out of 5, and I give it a 4 out of 5. Next up, we have 1990s Jacob's Ladder.
Every day, Jacob Singer goes to work.
What's wrong?
It's one of those days.
And every day, he wonders what is happening to him.
Maybe it's the pressure, Jake.
They're like demons, Jess. They weren't human.
What were they, Jake?
Don't look at your hand.
You have very strange lines.
See, according to this, you're already dead.
Something's wrong, Jake. They're coming after me. I don't know who they are or what they are, but they're gonna get me, and I'm scared, Jake. I've seen them too.
Maybe the demons aren't real.
He's running 106 feet.
This is barbaric.
I can get rid of the demons.
Who are you?
I can block the ladder.
Who are you?
Where are you taking me? Where am I?
Where do you want to go?
Home.
This is your home. You're dead.
I'm not dead.
What are you then?
I'm alive.
The film opens on October 6, 1971, where an American infantryman, Jacob Singer, is with the 1st Air Cavalry Division, deployed in a village in Vietnam's Mekong Delta, when his close-knit unit comes under sudden attack. As many of Jacob's comrades are killed or wounded, others exhibit abnormal behavior, with some suffering catatonia, convulsions, and seizures. Jacob then flees into the jungle, only to be stabbed by a bayonet by an unseen assailant. Jacob then awakens in a New York City subway, where, after glimpsing what he believes to be a tentacle protruding from a sleeping homeless person, an inexplicably locked subway station exit results in him almost being hit by a train. The year has fast-forwarded to 1975, where he works as a postal clerk and lives in a rundown apartment in Brooklyn with his girlfriend Jezebel. Jacob misses his old family and experiences visions of them, especially the youngest of his sons, Gabe, who had died in an accident before the war. Jacob becomes increasingly beset by disturbing experiences and apparitions, including glimpses of faceless vibrating figures, and narrowly escapes being run over by a pursuing car. He then attempts to contact his regular doctor at the local VA hospital, but after first being told that there is no record of him ever being a patient there, Jacob is told that his doctor has died in a car explosion. Later on, at a party thrown by friends, a psychic reads Jacob's palm and tells him that he is already dead, which Jacob dismisses as a joke. After declining to dance with her, he appears to witness an enormous creature penetrating Jezebel before he collapses, and then back at home, Jacob experiences a dangerous fever, which Jezzy attempts to bring down with the painful ice bath. Jacob then briefly wakes up in another reality where he lives with his wife and sons, including the still alive Gabe. And then in first-person perspective scenes of apparent flashbacks to his time in Vietnam, we see Jacob badly wounded, being discovered by American soldiers before being evacuated under fire in a helicopter. One of Jacob's former platoon mates, Paul, contacts him to reveal he is suffering from similar experiences, but is soon afterwards killed when his car explodes. Gathering after the funeral, other surviving members of the platoon confess that they have all been experiencing horrifying hallucinations and believing that they are suffering the effects of a military experiment performed on them without their knowledge or consent, they hire a lawyer to investigate. However, the lawyer quits the case after reading military files documenting that the soldiers were never in combat and were discharged for psychological reasons. Jacob's friends soon back down while Jacob suspects that they have been threatened into doing so, and he is then abducted by Sudan men who try to intimidate him. Jacob fights them and escapes, but is injured and nearly paralyzed in the process. He is then taken to a nightmarish hospital, where he is told that he has been killed and this is home, but his chiropractor friend Louis comes to his rescue and heals him. Jacob is then approached by a distressed man who was seen treating his wound in a medevac helicopter, and who also dragged him away from Paul's burning car. Introducing himself as Michael Newman, he tells the story of having been a chemist with the Army's Chemical Warfare Division, where he designed a drug that he called the Ladder, which massively increased aggression. Michael claims that to test the drug's effectiveness, a dose was secretly given to Jacob's unit before the battle, causing some of them to turn on each other in a homicidal frenzy. Michael's story triggers a vision of Jacob's wounding in Vietnam, which shows his attacker as a fellow American soldier. Jacob then returns to his family home, where he finds Gabe, who takes him by the hand and leads him up the staircase into a bright light. The scene then turns to a triage tent in 1971, as military doctors declare Jacob dead. The doctor notes that Jacob had put up a tremendous fight to stay alive, but looked peaceful in death, and the movie ends. This is one of those movies where you really have to pay attention to everything that's going on. Number one, because it jumps around a lot and it gets confusing as to what's really going on. And the biggest problem with this movie is that it's not weird, but it's really quite fucking bizarre with the weirdest shit going on. And you'll find yourself confused throughout most of it because it's really hard to understand what's going on. This is one of those movies that's a prime example of why I really don't like psychological horror movies. It just gets confusing. It just gets really confusing, and like I said, you really can't figure out what the hell is going on in it. But it has become a cult classic over the years, though I really don't understand why, but this is perfect cult movie material. And if you can sit through it, kudos, because I had a really hard time sitting through it and watching it through till the end. I rewatched this for this podcast, and it was probably like the third time I've seen it, and it's something I still have a really hard time sitting through. This had a budget of $25 million and only brought in $26.1 million at the box office. This was also followed by a remake in 2019, which, while it's not as confusing, it's really not all that good, so I wouldn't even bother with watching that. But anyway, IMDb gave this a 7.5 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 73%, Letterboxd a 3 out of 5, and I give it a 2.5 out of 5. Next up, we have 2016's Split.
Sir, I think you have the wrong car.
What are we doing here? What the hell is going on?
I was sent to get you for a reason.
Open the door! No!
Hey,
place, a flower on the pillows, a flower in the bathroom, like we're important.
The only chance we have is if all three of us go crazy on this guy.
Who is that? Maybe she can help us.
We're here! Help us!
We're in here!
Don't worry. He's not allowed to touch you. He knows what you're here for. He listens to me. My name's Hedwig.
How old are you?
9.
I've never seen a case like this before.
23 identities live in Kevin's body.
Who are you? Help me get out of here, Hedwig.
You're trying to trick me? I'll tell on you.
Aren't you the clever one?
An individual with multiple personalities can change their body chemistry with their thoughts.
Someone's coming for you.
Who's coming?
The beast.
There's a man here. He abducted us and he's going to kill me. We're meant for something. Something horrible.
Understand now. The beast is real.
He's done awful things to people, and he'll do awful things to you.
I'm gonna start this out by saying right off that I do not like M. Night Shyamalan movies. Except for like two, for the reasons that I will get into later in the podcast. But this is basically, Split is basically the conclusion to his Unbreakable trilogy, which started with Unbreakable. And then the second film was Glass. And then, this, concludes the quote unquote trilogy. But anyway, Kevin Wendell Crumb is a man struggling with dissociative identity disorder rooted in his history of childhood abuse and abandonment, and has been managing living with 23 distinct personalities, well, for several years, with help from his therapist, Dr. Karen Fletcher. The most dominant of his desirable alters, Barry, has been in control of deciding which personalities get to control Kevin's body, and lately he has not allowed Dennis, or Patricia, to have a turn due to the former's tendency to harass young girls, and the latter's belief in a mysterious entity called the Beast, who plans to rid the world of the impure, that is, those who have not suffered. Dr. Fletcher is concerned that when she realizes that Dennis has been impersonating Barry during their sessions, after questioning him about an incident where Dennis had been left disturbed when two teenage girls had placed his hands on their breasts while drunk. Meanwhile, just outside Philadelphia, Dennis kidnaps three girls, Claire, Benoit, and Marsha, when they are waiting in the car of Claire's father to get driven home from a birthday party, also reluctantly kidnapping their classmate Casey Cook after finding her in the passenger seat. He imprisons the girls in a secret underground lair beneath the Philadelphia Zoo, where they meet Patricia, who protects the girls from Dennis to save them from the Beast, and a 9-year-old boy, alter named Hedwig, revealed to be the true dominant alter, whom Patricia and Dennis are manipulating to shut out the other alters. The girls try to escape by going through the vents, manipulating Kevin's alters, and communicating with another individual via a walkie-talkie, but all their attempts end in failure. Dr. Fletcher then goes to the zoo to talk to Dennis, but she discovers Claire, so Dennis incapacitates the doctor and locks her up. Then he goes to the train station and boards an empty train, where the Beast takes over. The Beast, who displays enhanced strength and animalistic tendencies, returns to his lair, thanks Dr. Fletcher for her help, and crushes her to death. He then savagely feeds upon and kills Claire and Marsha before approaching Casey, but she calls out Kevin's full name, which brings forth his original personality. Upon learning of the situation and realizing that he has not been in control of his own body for 2 years, the horrified Kevin begs Casey to kill him with the shotgun he has hidden.
This then prompts all 24 personalities to fight for control, with Patricia the victor. She tells Casey that Kevin has been made to sleep far away and will not awaken now, even if his name is called. While Patricia returns control to the beast, Casey retrieves a shotgun and a box of cartridges and escapes into a tunnel. She manages to shoot the beast twice before running out of ammo, but he only sustains minor wounds. He then moves closer to murder her, but stops when he sees scars across her abdomen and chest, which are related to her having been abused by her uncle and legal guardian John, both before and after her father's death. Because she is quote-unquote pure, the beast spares Casey's life, and she is rescued the next morning by the police. In another hideout, Dennis, Patricia, and Hedwig discuss the power of the beast and their plans to change the world. At the Silk City Diner, several patrons watch a news report on the beast's crimes, with the correspondent mentioning that his numerous alters have earned him the nickname The Horde. A waitress then notes the similarity to a criminal in a wheelchair who was incarcerated 15 years earlier, who was also given a nickname. As she tries to remember it, the man sitting next to her replies that it was Mr. Glass, and the movie ends. I mentioned before that this was the last movie in the Unbreakable trilogy, but in reality, that was Glass, which was released in 2019. This was released in 2016, so pardon my fuck-up. I find this to be another annoying and silly film by the mediocre and way overrated Mr. Shyamalan. He basically rips off the plot of Identity, which I talked about earlier in this episode, and James McAvoy, who plays all 24 personalities in Kevin, is not scary, but rather laughable and ridiculous, and the psychologist is quite obviously absolutely incompetent, and the only really promising or likable character in this movie is Casey Cook. And plus, the conclusion of this is pretty pathetic, and is quite possibly the worst part of this forgettable film. This was made for $9 million and some fucking how brought in $278.5 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 7.3 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 77%, Letterboxd a 4 out of 5, and I give it a 2 out of 5. And that, dear listener, leads us into 2014's It Follows.
I used to daydream about being old enough to go on dates.
I had this image of myself holding hands with a really cute guy, driving along some pretty road. It was never about going anywhere, really. It's having some sort of freedom, I guess.
Jay, you awake?
What are you doing?
You're not going to believe me, and I need you to remember what I'm saying. This thing, it's going to follow you. Somebody gave it to me, and I passed it to you. Wherever you are, it's somewhere walking straight for you. All you can do is pass it along to someone else.
I'm scared. I need to find him.
Did it really do to you?
Apparently, he used a fake name to rent a house in the city.
This isn't real, I swear to you. This is just some game. If it kills her, it gets me. It goes straight down the line whoever started it. What exactly is supposed to be following you?
I don't know.
Something happened. It's not what she thinks, okay?
You don't believe me. Mom? No, it's me. Everything's okay.
It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. Whatever helps it get close to you.
The movie opens with a young girl named Annie fleeing from her house in fear, but there is no visible threat. She gets in her parents' car and drives to the beach, where she tearfully tells her dad over the phone she loves him. By dawn, it is revealed that she has been brutally murdered. We then cut to Jamie J. Height, an Oakland University student, going on a date with her new boyfriend Hugh to the movies. Hugh points out a young girl in the back of the theater, and when Jay says she cannot see the girl, Hugh becomes unnerved and asks that they leave. On another date, Hugh and Jay have sex in his car, but afterwards he incapacitates Jay with chloroform and she wakes up tied to a wheelchair. Hugh then explains that he has passed an entity onto her through intercourse and that it will perpetually be walking towards Jay's location at all times, no matter where she is. If it catches Jay, it will kill her and pursue the previous person to have passed it on. Hugh, who is passing it to Jay as leverage, Hugh's claims are proven real when a naked woman appears and walks straight for Jay. Hugh drives Jay home and then runs away. The next day, the police cannot find a naked woman or Hugh, who was living under a false identity. At school, Jay sees an old woman in a hospital gown walking towards her, invisible to others, and Jay's sister, Kelly, and her friends, Paul Boldan and Yara Davis, agree to help and spend a night in Jay and Kelly's house. That night, someone smashes a kitchen window, and Paul investigates but sees no one. Inside the house, Jay sees a disheveled, urinating, half-naked woman walking towards her and runs upstairs to the others who cannot see the entity. When a tall man enters the bedroom, Jay flees the house and her friends catch up to her at a nearby playground. With the help of their neighbor Greg Hannigan, the group discovers Hugh's real name, Jeff Redmond, and traces him to his address. Jeff's mother answers the door, and Jay realizes that the naked woman she had seen coming for her in the Packard plant was in the form of Mrs. Redmond. Jeff explains that the entity began pursuing him after a one-night stand and that Jay can pass it on by fucking someone else. Greg then drives Jay, Kelly, Yara, and Paul to his family's lake house and teaches Jay to shoot a revolver. The entity then arrives in the form of Yara and attacks Jay on the lakefront. Jay's friends ward it off by breaking a chair over its body, and Jay shoots it several times until it falls over, but it recovers unharmed and attacks Jay once again, this time taking the form of a boy who lives next door to Jay. She then flees in Greg's car, crashes into a cornfield, and wakes up in a hospital with a broken arm. Greg then has sex with Jay in the hospital, as he does not believe the entity exists. Days later, Jay sees the entity in the form of Greg walking towards Greg's house, smashing a window at Greg's house, and then entering. Jay tries to warn the real Greg by phone, but he doesn't answer, and so she runs into the house and finds the entity in the form of Greg's half-naked mother, knocking on his door before it jumps on Greg. Jay then sees the entity having sex with the dead Greg, then flees by car and spends the night outdoors. On a beach, Jay sees three young men on a boat, and she then undresses and walks into the water. Back home, Paul, eager to take the risk, offers Jay the opportunity to pass it on to him, but she refuses. The group then plans to kill the entity by luring it into a swimming pool and dropping electrical appliances into the water. Jay, waiting in the pool, spots the entity and realizes it has taken the appearance of her dead father, and instead of entering the pool, it throws the devices at her. Firing at an invisible target, Paul accidentally wounds Yara, but shoots the entity in the head. They then cover it with a sheet, and Paul shoots it once more, causing it to fall into the pool. As Jay tries to get out of the pool, it pulls her underwater by the ankle, and Paul shoots it again in the head and it sinks to the bottom, allowing Jay to escape. She then approaches the pool and sees it filling with blood, and Jay and Paul have sex. That night, Paul drives through town passing prostitutes, and later Jay and Paul walk down the street holding hands as a figure walks behind them, and the movie ends. This is another weird one, but it's actually quite good if you can get past the weirdness. It kind of uses, how should I put it? It kind of uses the threat of an STD as a supernatural entity, which is, when you think about it, really quite interesting, because that's something that's never really been done before. It's also very light on jump scares, which is a delightful change for once with modern horror. Because, at least in the last couple of years, horror movies, that's
that's a gimmick that horror movies have relied on way too often and way too much. And it gets really old after a while, and it's just refreshing to see a newer horror film avoid falling into the jump scare trap. This also has a very heavy sense of dread running throughout the entire movie, and which really adds to the atmosphere of it all. Like I said, it kind of uses STDs as a metaphor for supernatural entities, and it's also kind of like a really fucked up game of tag. And it's definitely one that I think you should see if you've never seen it before. This was made for $1.3 million and ended up raking in $23.3 million at the box office. IMDb gave it a 6.8 out of 10, Rotten Tomatoes a 96%, which is a fucking shock, Letterboxd a 3.5 out of 5, and I give it a 4 out of 5. And since this is a season finale, I thought I'd end it a little differently by talking about some things about certain horror movies that really annoy the hell out of me ever since I originally saw them and have continued to annoy me every time I watch them. And the first thing I'm going to talk about pertaining to that is in Child's Play 3, there's a scene where Chucky mails himself to Andy at the military academy. But how the fuck can he manage this? How did he package himself, wrap, and then address the package to Andy? It doesn't make any sense. Another thing that has always bothered me is that in zombie movies, you often see zombies coming right out of the ground. But how? I mean, it's not like we just dump bodies in holes and then cover them up with dirt. We put them in a metal box, bury them 6 feet underground with 6 feet of heavy packed dirt on top of the lid. So even if they have supernatural strength, there's still animated decaying matter. So that would be pretty much impossible to happen. Also, in every iteration of Halloween, Michael Myers is able to drive. Again, how? If he has been locked up in a mental hospital ever since he was 6 years old. Do mental institutions offer driving courses now, or what? Did he somehow just know how to drive? Another thing that doesn't really make any sense and irritates the hell out of me. And why the fuck is it so hard to make a good horror movie about sharks? Shark Night, the Sharknado franchise, both 47 Meters Down movies, The Meg, Two-Headed Shark Attack, any of the Jaws movies after the first one, etc. All of them just fucking suck. You'd think it would be an easy enough kind of movie to make, but apparently it isn't. And I know I'm not the only one that this bothers, but why do people always run upstairs when running away from the killers in the house? What possible good could that do? And why the fuck do they always run for the bathroom? How the fuck are you going to escape in a goddamn bathroom? And the final thing that bugs me, and I talked about this a little bit when I was doing the Splits segment, is how the fuck did M. Night Shyamalan become so popular? I like two of his movies, Unbreakable and The Visit, but everything else he's done, in my opinion, sucks. I mean, he's a quote-unquote master of the twist ending, but so what? That gets old when he includes them in every single one of the movies he does. A lot of his older movies were pretty much flops, and The Happening is still the brunt of jokes all these years after it was originally released. So why the fuck do they keep letting him make movies? It just, again, doesn't make any sense to me. And that just about wraps it up, guys. As always, you can email me at darksyde9034@gmail.com. And that's it, guys. I'm Dustin, and this has been Tombs of Horror. I'll see you all right back here on February 12th.